The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hello, Dr. Ray. I'm sure I'm going to get really good advice from you.
Why do I have to be the insightful professional?
Thank you for empowering me.
Here's what I think is going on.
I think you're a hoot and a half.
My idea, my theory, my guidance is a bit of a stretch.
I just love your show.
Does that comfort you?
No.
Am I close?
No.
You are really smart.
I am sensitive and understanding and nurturing.
Your show to me is like a comedy information show.
Did I make you feel a lot better or what?
No, you made me feel worse.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
My son said to me, as he was looking at something that I owned, "Boy, Dad, that must be an antique. It's from way back in the 1900s. I said, hey, calm down. It's from 1999. Good to have you with me. I am from further back in the 1900s. I don't want to say how further back, but my birthday cake had 50 candles, and that was the piece I had. Good to have you with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi. This is the Monday version, the typical Monday version of The Doctor Is In. This is E-Person Monday. Of course, those of you who have listened to E-Person Monday before, you recognize that I don't say email Monday. Striving ever diligently to be sensitive to the evolving changes in language, what you're allowed to say, what you're not allowed to say. The language police are everywhere, slapping you down, throwing the linguistic handcuffs on you, telling you you can't say that word. It's insensitive. And somebody in Nova Scotia might become offended. I'll tell you what, for all this talk about how people are self-confident, you can't be self-confident and be that easily offended. You can't have a strong self-image and be that easily offended. So I say e-person because I don't want to say email. It's patriarchal. Linguistically insensitive. We'll get to those momentarily. This is something that was, I don't know where these came from. This was an article. And I don't have all of these. I just got the... I've just got several of them where these are counselors that were asked, okay, tell us some things that people might... excuse me. Let me have a little sip here. People might not know about counseling or counselors or therapists. Anybody can call him or herself a psychotherapist or a therapist. You can do that. Anybody can say that. If you are calling yourself a psychologist, a psychiatrist, clinical social worker, marriage, family, or child counselor, you have to be licensed. That's true. You have to have a license to use those titles. It never hurts. Excuse me, to ask for a lower fee. Some counselors, excuse me, I was eating some mixed nuts right before the program here, and one of them got stuck. Never hurts to ask for a lower fee. That's true. Some people will say, indeed, I can't afford... I cannot afford what you're asking. And I will tell people in private practice, you can go on a sliding fee scale. Public agencies use a sliding fee scale. You can do this. This is an interesting one, and I am very much inclined to agree with this one. Long-term therapy makes some people much more self-absorbed. Yeah, they just focus on their navel and their gazing. They start to believe that their every thought, their every dream, Their every emotion that they have is ever so important. That's true. That can be a downside to this relentless spinning one's wheels in a long-term therapy session. There is a diagnosis called adjustment disorder. Adjustment disorder with mixed emotional features. Adjustment disorder not otherwise specified. Adjustment disorder, NOS. Which means you're having trouble adjusting to something in your life. And that can apply to almost anybody. The people who pay for therapy themselves seem to get better faster. The patients who rely on insurance, not quite as motivated. Well, depends. It depends on what the insurance covers. It also depends a little bit on whether they get better faster or they tend to leave faster. My experience has been, I don't take any insurance. So my experience has been that if you're paying for this out of your own pocket, you are more likely to say, all right, I think I'm sufficiently directed here that I'm not going to go to any more sessions. Don't ask things. Now, this is from a therapist saying this. Like, don't you agree? Now, if you're looking for approval, you may not get it. A good counselor is not there to say yes to everything. That's very true. I think it's one of the more difficult, delicate aspects of counseling is that you oftentimes may have to say something that the client may not want to hear. And depending upon how fragile they are about it, depending upon how many nerves are wrapped around it, you have to be real delicate in how you say it or what you say, and they could still get upset. Why wouldn't they? You're dealing with personal, emotional, behavioral, relationship issues that can be very, very fragile for the person. So no matter how much you attempt to be delicate about it, you can't gauge exactly how they're going to hear what you say. That's very true. I think that's one of the trickier parts of counseling. And then this one is really true, because I've had people say this to me so many times. I'm really hesitant to tell you this because I am so ashamed of it. I just don't think you've ever heard this before. I don't know if it has anything to do with how long I've been doing this or the fact that I see people in variety of settings. There's very little I have heard that I have not heard before. Sometimes here on the program, when somebody raises a question and I seem to anticipate the outcome of the situation they're telling me about, it's not because I have a third eye or third psychological ear. It's because I've heard that situation many, many, many times prior and know likely how those situations turn out. So if you say, I think this is going to happen, and they say, well, it's already happened, and you feel, I think, wow, how did he know that? Well, I didn't necessarily know that about their situation. I knew that about a whole lot of other situations that were similar to their situation. So just a few tidbits on counseling. One other thing people will say to me, how can I make sure that I get a counselor who's going to respect my worldview? I'm a religious person. I don't want somebody to give me direction that is immoral in my mind. I don't want to go to a counselor because I'm trying to adapt better to my marriage, and the counselor tells me, well, your spouse is toxic, you need to get out of it. That's not one of my options. Work with me on the other options. I don't want to go to a counselor who thinks that because I feel guilty about some sin I've committed, that I shouldn't feel guilty. I should not have any regrets because I am who I am and I need to be comfortable with whatever I do. I don't want to go to a counselor like that. I always tell folks, call if you're going to make an appointment. Ask to speak to the counselor for a few minutes. Now, if you've got somebody who screens all calls through a secretary receptionist and you can't get to the counselor, well, think about another counselor then. If you call me, you're going to get me. Why? Because you're calling from a delicate, ticklish, hurtful situation in your life. Now, I personally want you to talk to me. I don't want you to talk to somebody screening my calls. And then, well, Dr. Ray is too busy, so he'll see you next November at 4 a.m. Is that good enough? Oh, that's impersonal. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't start the relationship off well. I will talk to you. And if you ask me questions, say, for example, if you say to me, I want you to see my 9-year-old. Would you do that? And I say, no, but I'll talk with you. I'll work with you about how to better handle your 9-year-old. Or I want somebody who will respect my religious viewpoint. I'll do that. Certainly I'll respect your religious viewpoint. Or even if somebody says to me, I'm not religious, and I've heard that you have a radio program or a TV program on Catholic media. Oh, that's true. Well, I want you to know I'm an atheist. All right. Can you work with me? I believe so. Let's work on what it is in your life that is causing this distress and what's the result of all this. I've had a lot of people who are not necessarily religious folks. I've had a lot of people who don't know either way where religion sits in their lives. All right. I will work within that, never surrendering my own personal beliefs, but yet at the same time trying to help someone sort through what they're doing in their own life that's causing the trouble. All right, just a little primer there. When we come back, we'll get into this big stack of e-persons sitting in front of me. I'm Dr. Ray.
The Encounter Online Virtual Conference is December 27th through the 29th. 15 powerful speakers, prophecy, healing, and impartation. Do you want more?
The truth is, brothers and sisters, there is no solution to the cultural and church crisis but Jesus Christ the Lord, alive in a church that's empowered by the Holy Spirit. Period. That's it. He's finding out right now who's with me, who wants to live in the Spirit of God, who wants to follow me. That's what he's doing. It's going to be a work of God for the glory of the Father glorifying the Son in the power of the Holy Spirit through a people who are alive to him and are proclaiming him with everything they've got.
Register today at EncounterConference.org. That's EncounterConference.org.
Christianity never saw itself as the fulfillment of a political process or a military process. Christianity was always bearing witness to a kingdom ultimately not of this world. The Church teaches in Catechism of the Catholic Church that the kingdom of God lies ahead of us. It is brought near in the Word incarnate. It is proclaimed throughout the whole gospel, and it has come in Christ's death and resurrection. The kingdom of God has been coming since the Last Supper, and in the Eucharist, it is in our midst. The kingdom will come in glory when Christ hands it over to his Father. What this tells us is that we are working for a kingdom. For us, the kingdom of heaven is synonymous with the kingdom of God. His kingdom is to be established by virtue of our union with him.
Cresta in the Afternoon with Al Cresta. 4 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
you for joining me, Dr. Ray Guarendi. Program Doctor is in Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. This is E-Person Monday. Let's jump into the stack. My five-year-old nephew, over the past few months, has stopped talking to people at school and now at home. He now points or makes noises. Since a young age, he was very verbal. This is a big change. He will talk to me a little if we're alone and says, I don't say this word, but okay, I'll say it. Or they say something in different words. For the last few years, he's stuttered a little when he's tried talking too fast. He's also been afraid to open his mouth without a mask on. He seems to be getting worse, not talking or participating at school or even talking at home. Do you have any recommendations? None of us know what to do to help him through this. Andrea, when I worked as a consultant to several Head Start programs, occasionally we came upon a child who did not talk at all. The fancy word for it is selective mutism. Did not talk at Head Start, but the parents conveyed that he was a chatterbox at home. So there was something about the context at Head Start that kept him quiet. Now, Andrea, in this situation here, several explanations, possibly. Has there been any regression overall? In other words, have you seen a slip back in his level of comprehension when people say things to him, or every other indication is that he's developing normally, that there isn't something going on neurologically or physiologically that would bring about this kind of verbal expression regression? That's the first thing. So you want to rule that out. Stuttering. It may be that as he tries to talk too fast, this is common, that he stutters and he trips over his words, and so he's become a little embarrassed by this. If you ask him to talk more slowly, he might be a little more willing to say things. But then there's an interesting thing you said here, and this is something I would perhaps chase with this little guy, to the degree he can understand you. You said he's also been afraid to open his mouth without a mask on. Little kids, like everybody else, have to interpret their world. I've talked about this many, many times regarding mask wearing for little kids. Little kids, I don't think they just flow with this like the big people think. Oh, yeah, they just put a mask on. That's okay, that's what they do. No, there are those little kids who are going to interpret masks as a bad sign. Is my mommy and daddy going to get sick because they don't have their mask on? Do they need to wear a mask so that they don't get sick? What about me? Do I have to wear a mask because I'm going to get really sick, or could I die? I mean, little kids think this stuff. They do. Anybody tells you they don't is wrong. Little kids have to interpret extreme changes in behavior, and they put their own meaning to it. They don't automatically just say, oh, okay, I got to wear a mask. Okay, no big deal. Now, some do. I'm kind of shocked at how many seem to accept this. But this little guy may be one who is saying to himself, if I speak, am I going to spread germs? So therefore, I better not speak. And maybe I'll speak if I have a mask on. But if I don't have a mask on, I don't want to spit on somebody and make them sick and die. So, Andrea, I would have you or this little guy's parents ask him this. Do you think if you talk, you could make somebody sick? Ask him. Is he misinterpreting a mask? Is he thinking, I better not say much because I don't want to make somebody sick? Or even, I don't want to make somebody die. Of course. It's just one of the things we grown-ups don't anticipate when little kids have to understand the world around them. When you are little, there's a real good chance that that thing can go inside your head that you interpret and do a couple of backflips, twist and turn, turn left, turn right, and come out as what looks to be inexplicable behavior. But in fact, if you knew what was spinning inside the child's head, it wouldn't be so inexplicable. One other possibility. I call it a quirk. And a quirk can get on a roll. For whatever the reason, maybe it's related to the mask, maybe it's not, maybe it's related to the stuttering, maybe it's not. This little guy's decided it's better just to keep my mouth shut. It's safer to keep my mouth shut. All right, that's quirk. It's just something he's concluded. Don't necessarily know why, if it's not related to the mask, if it's not related to the stuttering. Okay, it's not related to any kind of intellectual overall regression. Then he's just doing it. And what I used to advise the teachers at Head Start, I would say, well, if this child wants something, they have to make a modest effort at asking. Even if it's just please. May I? So what I would suggest, Andrea, is that little five-year-olds really can't navigate day-to-day life without their parents' help. So if he wants Halloween candy that he's stored up, if he wants to watch something on TV, they have to look at him and they have to say, well, you need to ask. Now, I've seen that work for most kids with selective mutism. We may never totally understand the etiology or the original causes of this, but we can still deal with it. And we can get him out of the habit of not saying anything. Because typically what is happening is when he points or grunts, probably his parents acquiesce. So that's good enough. I'm reminded of the joke of the young six-year-old who just never talked. One morning, he said, this cereal's cold. And all the adults around him went crazy, just all jumping up and down, asking him, you haven't talked. You haven't talked all your life. Now you're talking. What is it? And he said, up to now, everything's been fine. So in some respects, if this little guy can get by with just pointing, or making hand gestures, and that's good enough, he may rely on that. He may actually fuel his non-speaking. Tell your, let's see, nephew, okay, so I don't know if it's your sister or brother, but tell them, see what happens when you start requiring some verbalizations to get things that you know he would like.
The Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge that and to say, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What comes to your mind when you hear the word passion? Passion often signifies intensity of emotions and feelings, frequently in terms of lust. But the Catholic Catechism tells us passions are neither good nor bad in and of themselves. In other words, passions are morally good if they contribute to a good action, and evil if they bring about the opposite result. The most fundamental passion is love, says the Catechism. It is aroused by attraction to the good, the desire to attain the good, and fulfilled by joy and pleasure once the good is possessed. Evil, on the other hand, arouses hatred, aversion, and fear. Passions are the passageway connecting the senses and the mind. Jesus said the source of all passions was the human heart. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Thank you for joining me, Dr. Ray Guarendi. The doctor is in. This is E-Person Monday. Big fancy shows have wire services. They have big bunches of producers. I have something better. I have you. Folks like you often send me information, things you know about, I have no idea about. You send them to me and it expands my base of knowledge, if I can remember it. This is an example. Dr. Ray, I just heard part of your program where the caller said they keep taking their son's cell phone away, but friends keep giving him new ones. That's very common, by the way, because you can bet that 90%+ of your child's, adolescents, teens, friends, if your child doesn't have a phone yet, his friends are regaling him with what Neanderthals you are. Psycho parents. I've heard that phrase used a lot by their peer group. An easy solution, Dr. Ray, is an electronic device called a selective cellular jammer. The user of this device, I guess, defines a list of friendly cell phones called the whitelist. Could be grandma's cell phone. Could be mom's and dad's cell phone. That will never be blocked. Consequently, now I'm not real sophisticated, and I'm trying to phrase this in such a way that it's understandable even to me. Consequently, when the system is jamming, selective cellular jammer, I don't know where you would get them. When the system is jamming, a second system provides a clear channel within the jamming boards. This allows the whitelist numbers to go through at the same time all the others are jammed. Okay. All right. I think I got that. So in other words, it says here on a phone whatever the phone is. I guess any phone this will work on if you have the jamming device. It doesn't just work on a particular phone. In parallel, if there are cellular devices, apparently this means an iPod, something, that will try to use the fake signal to conduct phone calls to the outside, to the regular cellular network, they will be automatically blocked. This feature allows the user, I mean, this is the kid, I guess, to communicate freely without the concern of being blocked by a selective jammer. I think I'm understanding this. There is a device, and I don't know who you'd talk to about this. Maybe some cell phone repair place. Maybe even a computer repair place. Selective cellular jammer. And what it does is any phone, I guess, within the house that is targeted can block all numbers except the numbers that are programmed into it that say, okay, these numbers can go through. So whatever numbers come in from bad sources or friends you don't want in contact with your child, it's jammed. I didn't know this. I still don't quite understand it, but it really sounds pretty good. My son keeps saying that I am disappointed that he is not the quarterback. Does he really believe this? Because it could not be further from the truth. Now, by the way, this is coming from a mother. Because you'd immediately think, okay, this has got to be dad. You know, he wants his kid to vicariously live through his kid as the quarterback. I tell him work hard, and that's all he has control over, but the decision is ultimately the coach's. How do I approach this? Besides telling him I love him over and over again. I'm just afraid he feels badly. He didn't win the spot. And he's trying to reach out for help. Boys are confusing. Now that is not something I hear more often than girls are confusing, adolescent girls. But she says boys are confusing. I pray to help me do things to show my love, and I pray not to confuse him. Thank you. Okay, Mom, I would just point blank ask him, where are you coming from with this? Rather than to say, I don't think that. I don't think that. I love you. It doesn't matter to me. I don't think that. No. Turn it around. How'd you come to this conclusion that I think this? Where's this coming from? Now, maybe he'll say some things that you didn't realize in the beginning of things was your natural excitement. Wouldn't that be great if you're quarterback? Oh, my gosh, that would be so exciting. I'd love to come and watch your games. My son's quarterback. And your natural exuberance for him being the quarterback, he misinterpreted as, if I don't get to be the quarterback, Mother, you're going to be so very disappointed in me. That's probably what happened. In your attempt to be supportive and uplifting and encouraging and all your excitement about the fact that he could be quarterback, he interpreted that I better be quarterback because if I'm not, oh, what a blow to her enthusiasm. And you could approach it from that direction too. You could say, are you thinking that all of my excitement early on about you having a chance to be the quarterback means that because you're not, I'm all disappointed? Is that what you're thinking? So you gotta put on this puzzled kind of air, like I don't get that. I don't understand that. Then sometimes in situations like this, where the kids are just flat out convinced that they're going to look at it a certain way no matter what you say, sometimes I just kind of shut the book. I go, well, I guess you can think what you want, and there's nothing I can do to convince you otherwise. But you're wrong. That's it. The one thing, Mom, I don't want you to do is to think that, oh, therefore he thinks you don't love him because he's not the quarterback. See, something like that I'd probably get upset at. I'd say, you know, that's so ridiculous. I don't even know how to respond to it. There's nothing you could do that would make me not love you. Well, maybe, okay, maybe if you're not running back. I could understand that if you're not running back and you can't run a 4.3 40, which is professional level. No, I wouldn't. I'm teasing. Well, linebacker, maybe. Okay, so I would tell you there's nothing you can do. It's going to make me not love you. Not the least of which is not being a quarterback. I don't know how he got this in his head, Ma. You probably don't either, but my best guess is he probably misinterpreted your excitement. I never was quarterback. My mom was happy I wasn't quarterback. My mom was happy she wouldn't let me play football because the coach came after me and wanted me to play football. And I wasn't allowed. So therefore, I never went out with any of the cute girls.
EWTN home video highlight for November is Speak of the Devil, Spiritual Warfare. This EWTN original docudrama based on the parable of the prodigal son imparts valuable insights on how to be battle ready in the spiritual war we all face. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
I tell oftentimes an experience that I had at Divine Child when I was a young priest, 1 year ordained. First time I ever really saw the power of the Blessed Sacrament. And we simply exposed the Blessed Sacrament at the end of Mass one night. I encouraged people. I said, you know what, we've been in the habit of praying over people after Mass. I said, we're not going to do that this week. I'm just going to invite people to come on up and pray if they want to pray. And I put the Blessed Sacrament on the altar. I kneeled down. As I kneeled down, the church is in the sanctuary. The whole church. And as I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the people there, and I'm looking at Jesus under the appearance of bread there, I saw the Lord standing on the altar, and he's just standing there looking out at all the people. And then at a certain point, he turned towards me, and he just bowed, and he says, "Don't you see how easy this is? You don't have to do anything. You just have to put me out. You put me out, and I will work."
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray. My latest book, Jesus, the Master Psychologist, Listen to Him, talks about how Jesus was 2,000 years ahead of modern enlightened psychology. If he's God, he knows the absolute best way to live, whether psychology agrees or whether it doesn't. Go to AveMariaRadio.net to get your copy. Jesus will tell you the best way to live. Fixated in the oral stage, little Freudian lingo there. See, Freud's theory was back in, he was back in Victorian moral ages from Austria, that people went through what he called psychosexual stages. Oral, anal, latency stage, various stages. And if you didn't deal with the conflicts in those stages, that they surfaced again when you were an adult. So if somebody had conflicts in the oral stage, which was the very beginning of life stage, then he was likely to go on and do something that had to do with talking. Now, probably radio. So I was just assuming I was fixated in the oral stage. This is E-Person Monday of the Doctor's Inn. We have a 3-year-old daughter turning 4 this month who does, see, the reason I took this one is not because, see, somebody might say, well, Dr. Ray, come on, I can't relate to a 3-year-old or 4-year-old discipline question. Yeah, you can, because the reason I picked it is it illustrates an awful lot of misunderstandings that we parents have or that young parents have more commonly now. We have a 3-year-old daughter turning 4 this month who does not listen well. All right, stop the tape. 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds don't listen well. They want to do what they want to do. So if we use words alone to ask them or to tell them, they're not naturally going to say, oh, well, of course, Father, I most certainly will. I recognize that you're the adult and you know so much more about life than I do. No, when a parent says a 3 or 4 or any age kid doesn't listen well, what they're really saying is I'm using too many words and I'm expecting this child to respond to my words. Now, Dad acknowledges, he says, I know she's still young and developing mentally, emotionally, but what are ways we can discipline her? If she continues to defy us, well, Dad, she's going to continue to defy us because she's a kid. Even though we clearly lay out the expectations. She's going to be 4, so she is plenty old enough to be disciplined in a very basic way, whether it's sitting on the steps or standing in the corner or go laying on her bed. Something along those lines, you can do this because she certainly can make that connection. If A, then B. I always say this to parents, do you have a dog? Yes. Well, is your daughter smarter than your dog? Well, yeah, of course. But you train your dog. You trained your dog to go outside and potty. Your dog didn't understand. Your dog had no conceptual grasp of why he's supposed to go outside and do his business rather than on your carpet. But you taught him that. Well, children are much, much smarter than dogs. Well, maybe not Lassie or Rin Tin Tin, but your basic dog. So she is well within the age of when you ask her something, tell her something, tell her to do something, not to do something, and she just blows you off. She ignores you. She defies you. She melts down, whatever. She's in the corner. We've tried taking away toys or activities that she enjoys. Okay, that is one approach. The problem with it is the average 3 and 4-year-old is going to resist doing what you'd like them to do multiple times a day, 10, 15, 20 times a day. So you can't really take away enough things to have an impact. You can't take away enough things to be consistent. You're going to have a workhorse consequence. I like the corner. I like the steps. I like putting her in a playpen. Whatever. Laying on her bed. Sitting in a chair. Something you can do rather than to take away. Because you could still take away things, but you can't take away enough things to be consistent enough to deal with all the stuff she's doing. Because that's what she does. She's 3 or 4. She's totally unsocialized. She's totally without morals. She's completely self-centered. She wants to do what she wants to do the instant she wants to do it, and you're in the way. So that is the nature of the beast. We've tried taking away toys or activities, but that doesn't seem to change her attitude. Well, no, of course not. Because one, you can't take away enough. Two, she's 3 going on 4. This is a lifelong thing here. This is not something where we're going to go, oh, goody, she's 4 and a half, she's now cooperative. Well, that's not going to happen. So, you persevere in your consequence. Now, here's the key. I always ask parents this in parent counseling. If you say go to the corner, please, is she going to go to the corner? See, there's the difference. Parents say, well, we've tried the corner, it doesn't work. And then I ask them, well, does she go? Well, no, she fights us. Well, then you're not trying the corner because it doesn't work because you're not doing it. So you have to decide what you're going to do if she refuses the corner. It only makes her angry in the moment. In one of my early books, I talked about something called escalation. An escalation is a child's response to discipline. If you put a consequence on me, I get mad. Well, of course, I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to get angry. I usually tell parents you discipline the anger too. In other words, if you get mad because I'm putting you in a corner, you're in a corner longer. I don't want to deal with your emotional outbursts because I try to hold you accountable in teaching you to do or not to do certain things. It just makes sense. And the irony is, if you have the authority to say, please go to the corner, you won't have to use it very often because she knows. All right, what else we got here? What guidance would you have for us regarding age-appropriate discipline? Oh, like I said, I like the corner. I like the steps. I like the couch. I like the head down at the table, laying on the bed. Just simple stuff. It doesn't have to be fancy. The reason it works is because you can do it over and over. The average 3 to 4 year old, if you keep a close eye on it, misbehaves many times per day. Many times. That's what you would expect. Because they are at the very front end of being socialized and moralized. As a result, they're just a walking bunch of impulse. And you have to teach them. When mommy and daddy say something, it is for your good, and I will back it up with action. How quickly will that work? I'd say maybe by time her wedding rehearsal dinner floats around anyway, probably. Well, okay, it may work quicker than that, but the progress could be slow. It's just the way it is. If she does something wrong, she's gone to the corner. But Dr. Ray, she's still doing something wrong. Yes. So why do you still go to confession? Apparently, you're still doing something wrong. Why haven't you learned? The daughter has an excuse. She's only 4. I have no excuse. I've been doing this for decades. So that would be my suggestion. Another suggestion I have is I have a book called Discipline That Lasts a Lifetime. It is 100 of the most common discipline questions I get asked, ages 2 to 18. There's about 4 other books I have there on discipline, but that is the one that probably most people gravitate towards. However, if they want to have 0 psychological gaps in their parenting discipline, they get all the books. It's on my website. I'm Dr. Ray.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. All religions have myths and ideas about a great God who made the world. But no religious teachers except Jesus Christ ever claimed to be that man. G.K. Chesterton said this about that.
The most that any religious prophet had ever said was that he was the true servant of such a being. But that the Creator was present in the detailed daily life of the Roman Empire, that is something utterly unlike anything else in nature. It is the one great startling statement that man has made since he spoke his first articulate word instead of barking like a dog.
And that's Evidence for Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Well, that could be the most non-depressive instrument of all time, the banjo. I would say a harmonica, but a harmonica can be kind of bluesy. I think it's really hard to be depressed, you know, if you're playing a banjo or listening to a banjo. This is one that is related very closely to the previous E person. And again, I'm using it because it reveals some common thinking, not necessarily so completely directed toward the question itself. Our four-year-old son is displaying strong signs of having ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. This isn't something you have. It's not an affliction that you get. It is a label that is used to describe a lot, in somebody's judgment, usually a clinician, some type, a lot of defiant behavior. Okay? It says nothing about how that defiant behavior came about. It just simply says the kid challenges and resists rules. Now, the number one factor in a kid being diagnosed oppositional defiant disorder is parenting. Because if, in fact, the discipline is erratic or permissive or uncertain or tentative or not firm enough, the child will push. Most will. And they will push harder as they get older. And as they push harder, it looks like something is wrong with them. They have a disorder. Most likely oppositional defiant, but as a kid gets older, it's called conduct disorder. And as a person continues, it's called antisocial personality disorder. His behavior is actually a danger to other children. Discipline does not change his behavior. I have never come across a kid where discipline does not change. Okay, maybe I shouldn't say that. It's rare. Very rare. Parents will say, this is a version of, we've tried everything with this child, nothing works. First of all, he's only four. So when a parent says discipline doesn't change his behavior, we need to look at ourselves. We need to say, what am I doing, not doing, that this child is not getting the message that there are rules and limits he has to follow? Our very good Catholic pediatrician recommended a practic Catholic behavior specialist who happens not to take insurance. Okay, if this behavior specialist will work with you, Mom, then I'm all for it. You're not going to get a four-year-old to go into play therapy and correct his behavior problems at home because those are a function of the dynamics that's going on at home. 95% of the time, it is the discipline dynamics on the part of the parent. And by the way, 50% of the parents who come into my office do not think that. They think this child is just a hellion that nobody on God's green earth could raise because he's so strong-willed and he has oppositional defiant disorder. And in fact, I will tell you that if the parents do the things we talk about, and I ask them several weeks later, you still think he's ODD? No. No. Still think he's strong-willed? No. Right, because the parent has made the changes. We can't afford to take our son to this particular doctor, and I'm reluctant to take him to someone who might have different values. Do you think that as his age, it's okay to go to a specialist we can afford? Mom, not necessarily his age. It's you. You would be the one who would make the changes in all likelihood. Now, I don't know you. I don't know your son, so I can't say for certain. But I'm going to tell you, 95% of the time, maybe more, that parents come to me with an out-of-control four-year-old, it is a function of the parenting. I ask him one simple question. I'll say, if you told him to go to the corner, would he go? And they'll say, no, he won't go. He'll throw a fit. He'll melt down. He'll refuse. He'll resist. I'll say, well, then you have no authority. And if you have no authority, it doesn't surprise me at all that he's defiant across all kinds of situations and that he hits other kids. That doesn't shock me. I don't think anything is necessarily wrong with this child. That's, I guess, the point I want to make. Get so many kids diagnosed ODD, there's nothing wrong with them. But it sounds like there is oppositional, defiant disorder. Something's wrong with him. The vast majority of cases, nothing is wrong with the child. This is the discipline skills of the parent. Not saying they're bad parents, very loving, good parents. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying the parent is underestimating what they need to do. And this is such a common phenomenon, and it definitely reflects radical changes in the way we approach children from 40 years ago. The average parent 40 years ago had much more control over kids than we do now. Much more. Because we've altered our approach. We've become more talkative and more reasoning and more jelly bean jar and more win-win scenarios and more active listening, all of which can work with some kids here and there. But the average kid is going to push. And when they push, if the parent doesn't have authority, isn't firm enough, child can look real bad. And most of the time, thank heavens, there's nothing wrong with the child. All right, gotta go. I'm Dr. Ray, and I do appreciate so very much your help. Dan McGraw, thank you for everything you've done on that end. Walk with God. And when you have a kid who's much better behaved, it's easier to walk with God.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.